My name is Andy. I help people and organizations connect to purpose and make a difference in the world. In these wild and uncertain times, this podcast is an invitation towards better futures, exploring the mystery, beauty, and complexity of life through conversations with an array of incredible people, all of them working at the edge of what's possible for humanity. This is a place for big dreams, bold creativity, and fierce hope. Welcome to the Wonder Dome. If you're inspired by this conversation and you'd like to see it reach more people, you can help by sharing it with friends and colleagues, subscribing, giving us a 5-star rating, and best of all, leaving a glowing review. If you'd like to go even further, consider becoming a member of my small but mighty community of monthly supporters. You'll help me keep the lights on and provide funding to a wide range of charitable causes. You can learn more at thewonderdomepodcast.com.
My guest today is Deborah Eden Tull. Eden is the founder of Mindful Living Revolution and teaches the integration of compassionate awareness into every aspect of our lives. She's an engaged Buddhist teacher, a spiritual activist, an author, an eco-dharma educator, and a facilitator of something called the Work That Reconnects, which is a field of study and experiential learning created by the Buddhist scholar and philosopher Joanna Macy, who is someone I often quote on this podcast for her amazing work in helping us transform our love and our pain for the times we find ourselves in the world into compassionate action. So Eden has been bringing all of that, including her studies with Joanna, into her teachings, into her writings, and most recently, her newest book, which serves as the centerpiece for our conversation. It's called Luminous Darkness, an engaged Buddhist approach to embracing the unknown, and was released just back in 2022. The book is an invitation to meeting the unknown, meeting the so-called darkness of our lives, both the literal after the sun goes down darkness and the parts of our lives and the parts of reality that we are taboo for us, that we avoid, that we're afraid of, that we're unwilling to talk about, and what becomes possible when we move towards those. And those of you who have been listening for a while know that these themes are so important to me because I have personally experienced, not through working with Eden specifically, but more generally in my own journey, what happens when we turn towards that which we either fear or we are up until that moment unaware was even there. Eden also unpacks the way in which our society could benefit from this approach. Literally, we have modern capitalist industrial society has pushed actual darkness, the absence of sunlight, further and further away with unnatural light, with electric light. And of course, that brings wonderful conveniences and luxury, and there are times when that's quite beneficial, but it's very hard for most people these days to walk out at night and actually see what the night sky looks like. And we're scared of it, we're afraid of it, and we're losing something that for millions of evolutionary years, I mean, really the entire evolutionary span until modern civilization, was defined by the rhythm of day and night. And so that rhythm lives in us and moves in us. And Eden's work is the beautiful work of helping us reconnect to that rhythm so that we might make wise choices about how we want to meet these moments of disruption and breakdown, whether that's working for social justice or ecological justice or political integration or being able to talk across difference, even when it's upsetting, and still make progress and still invite people into relation. It's the heart of Eden's work and the heart of our conversation. It's a really rich and juicy one. So let's get settled in. and hear what Eden has for us. Hi, Eden. Welcome.
Grateful to be here with you. Good morning.
Yeah. Good morning to you. I have to just share, I was really, really touched to hear that you're sitting near the spot where you first learned about this podcast. Is that right? At Esalen?
Yeah, I'm teaching at the Esalen Institute. And this is where, on a recent teaching trip here, someone shared your podcast with me and named that it was their favorite podcast.
Oh, it's so sweet. I'm so tickled by that. I love the way the world works, the way that these little recommendations and possibilities can bring people together. So you have written a number of books, but the book that I've read, Luminous Darkness, I'm sitting here kind of with my hands on it, was really impactful, a really beautiful look at some of the aspects of spiritual practice, of meditation, of self-care, of self-knowing that aren't really necessarily celebrated by our culture, by the self-help movement. There's something here that you're pointing towards in this book that I hope we can bring people into in our conversation today.
Thank you. Me too. And I'll share that the subtitle is An Engaged Buddhist Approach to Embracing the Unknown. One of the subtitles we played with was A Radical Path to Wholeness, because on the spiritual path in life, just the experience of being human, when we're willing to look more deeply and really embrace the full spectrum of light and dark, not push one half away, there's a real invitation that I believe people are hungry for in today's world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I'm also just present to the teacher of darkness today, because this is a transition day here where I'm teaching, one workshop ending, another beginning in a couple of days, people beginning their journey home after a really beautiful and intense inner journey. And the darkness, in a way, you know, symbolizes the unknown, liminality, transition. And oftentimes we go to sleep in transition. We're kind of like, okay, that's done. Now I can go to sleep till the next thing. Or sort of become a little less attuned as I'm going home and maybe going back into my stories. Does that resonate with you?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really fun to just have a practice of especially staying present in our transitions.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks for naming that right at the top. There's something both wonderfully affirming and also a bit sort of lovingly provocative in the way I hear what you said, which is this sort of say, hey, you know, it's normal when we go back towards our regular zone for us to drop back into whatever patterns of thinking or feeling. And, you know, that's just, hey, that happens. When we transition back, it's easy to turn off a light that had been turned on or to turn on a light that had been turned off. And just check, when you go back, do you want to go back? Are you really the same person who left? Who are you going back as now? And what does that mean for how you show up in your I'm putting this in air quotes, your regular day-to-day life? It's just very, very... I think maybe there's a part of me that's resonating. I'm a father of three kids. It's the winter season. There are bugs coming in and out. It's really easy to just try and like grind and get through and just survive. But yeah. I've also, it brings up sadness and loneliness. And even for me, some anger at our kind of system of care for both the children who need care and also the caretakers who need care, but don't always have the support they need to get it. And, you know, I say that from a pretty strong position of privilege. It's so humbling to think about all of us who are working hard to care for others and don't have that space to be with our own inner pain or inner turmoil or suffering, and just kind of turn off the light, don't stay awake, just get through it, just survive. You know, I want to honor the survival energy, but also receive your invitation to pay closer attention.
Yes. And I think just bringing compassion up at the very start of our conversation for everyone who is navigating, well, as we talk about it in Buddhism, moving through life with one foot in the relative world and one foot in the absolute. So one foot in this realm of pressures and external pulls and the support for unconsciousness that there is, and honoring that. That's at least one half of our existence. While also honoring possibility and our deeper intentions for remembering who and what we are beyond that. And so, even in this recent period, I got really sick and had someone, a community member, a Sangha member, sort of tending to me during that time, and just recognizing the generosity of that and what that took of that human being. And so, part of what we're pointing to now is remembering to rest in the pause, remembering to turn to, and we can even think of darkness as those moments of resting in being and pausing rather than activity and doing to integrate our human experience more. And with so much pressure from capitalism, from the busy terrain that humans spend so much time on to do, to survive, we can sometimes forget the pause. You with me?
Yeah, I'm appreciating this kind of foot in the relative world, foot in the absolute world. It can sometimes feel like the relative world is grabbing me by both my feet and sort of sweeping me off my feet and pulling me in. And then, there's a moment where my son just wants to give me a hug, or I walk out in the middle of the day or at last light and catch a certain ray of sun just so, or stand up high enough to see the horizon, and then I'm reminded that there is a much wider field of possibility. And that's those little reminders of the absolute are essential for me to stay anchored in the kind of like intensity of both feet running in the relative world.
Yes. And how beautiful that those moments exist. They're woven throughout our ordinary existing life as it is. Like, there can be stories that I need to go away to meditate in the cave, or awaken on retreat, or to go far away. But that ultimately our practice exists in ordinary everyday life. And that's where sort of ordinary mysticism emerges for us. Yeah. Both and. I hear you.
You use this wonderful word in the book early on, as a sort of balance to the word enlightenment, which we hear a lot about and comes freighted with all sorts of stories and ideas. And some of that is in there, like, oh, you must go to the cave and meditate and become enlightened, and only when you're, and you use the word endarkenment. And I loved that word. I had not heard it before until reading this. And maybe we're dancing with it already, but maybe you could speak a bit more to what you mean when you say endarkenment.
Sure, yeah. And first, I'll say, gratitude to who I was as a young person, drawn to the path of enlightenment and all that inspired me in that direction. But it also inspired a side in me where I became identified for quite some time with sort of the solo heroic spiritual warrior. Have you had any of that in your path? Trying to battle the dark to get to the light. Trying to kind of a frame of if I can just fix and solve my demons, then I can get to that place, this place I've heard of. A sense of holding kind of in a spiritually bypassing way that I wasn't aware of, judgment towards the dark, trying to transcend being human, the messy, more difficult, more emotional aspects of being human, the shadows that we can think of shadows for listeners as those aspects of our being that don't line up with how we really see ourselves or want to be perceived, but here they are. And if we're willing to, when I'm talking about endarkenment, I'm talking about recognizing that light and dark equally are our teachers of love, of transformation, if we're willing for that, and that there's a fierce compassion that emerges in us when we're willing to really question and drop the hierarchical perception that's running in most people's minds. If they do some investigation, they'll see this, that's constantly labeling light versus dark, good versus bad, better versus worse, higher, lower. See this play out internally, and so we might judge aspects of ourselves that in the end, for instance, in my path, judging shadows that I found out were my greatest allies. Power I had been afraid of, for instance, or how that plays out into the world, judging aspects of humanity. I mean, this hierarchical perception, this binary perception of light and dark becomes the seed of, I believe, every ism we face. It becomes the seed of xenophobia and racism. It's pervaded human consciousness for a really long time. So this book inviting us on many levels to question this binary perception around light and dark, and to consider what might be a deeper, what we speak of in Buddhism as original consciousness, a more original perception that's actually free of that. And then how do we experience darkness in a radically different way? Recognize how darkness is a brilliant aspect of nature and consciousness, and that darkness is neutral, as is light, but it's our judgments that have been framing this battle between the two.
I wonder if you could speak to some part of yourself, a shadow that you were afraid of that turned out to be a great ally. Could you bring that to life to us?
Well, in the book, one that I write about is the shadow of anger. And maybe there are listeners who can relate, but I know I was brought up, as I believe many of us were, with a kind of, here are the welcome emotions, but anger isn't one of them. And then spiritual practice can also get framed in kind of a do not be angry. A good spiritual person is beyond that. So there's a lot of conditioned judgments towards anger. And I share the experience of arriving to the Buddhist monastery where I trained, where I moved, where I was 26, kind of maybe some expectation that I would drop into some deep peace immediately. Hey, surprise, surprise. And within the first week, I met this aspect of my being who I labeled Electra because she was electric with anger that I had never known. I had never known. That's the degree to which, even as a conscious person, I had pushed that anger down. I knew grief, but this was deep down beneath the grief. I had been conditioned to be someone who is trying to, who is always likable and who was trying to be nice instead of being kind. Kindness never leaves out ourself. It doesn't leave anyone out. But trying to be nice can be a very message some of us have gotten. So it was brilliant that at 26 I got to face that shadow. Had a conversation with my teacher where I was so apologetic for bringing this angry energy to the monastery. And she was completely in her freedom over any of those judgments. She said, okay, great. You've probably never gotten to know this part of you ever. So here's your chance. So working in the garden, dig in the soil with her, go on walks with her, like get to know this part of you free of judgment with pure curiosity. What is the experience of anger and how does it pulse through you? And what's the story of this aspect of your being? And that's when it really became clear that it was so much bigger than me, that it was ancestral, that it was an energy not to be pushed away, but to be embraced. And through that work, I certainly would not be who I am today without that work. So much more freedom, so much more courage, so much more fearlessness, so much more passion and chutzpah, could be expressed without judging this fire energy.
Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah.
It's been I alluded to this a little bit already, but I'll just really underline it that for me, it's been a maybe one of the toughest emotional seasons for me in the past few months, for a variety of reasons. And we're just getting over the flu in my household right now. So I got the chance to go for a walk after a few days, just pretty much lying around in bed. And this is in part connects to the like relative absolute conversation we had earlier. Like I just seeing the sun on the sun and the shadows on an old tree near our house, seeing the way the clouds kind of painted across, I was just like, I can't look at this. Wow. It was really, really nourishing. But I also had what felt like an insight, and I'm curious to hear how this lands with you, which was this sense that the parts of me that are sad or lonely or hurting are finally going, okay, Andy's safe enough to be around now that we can come. We've been waiting. We've really been waiting to come, and he can handle it now. So even though it kind of has been catching me off guard, the sort of some anger I've been feeling and some sadness, and at the same time, I do feel like I have an attitude of, okay, I'm here, I'm listening. And so I just curious how that lands you, this sense of that as we open ourselves more to these parts of ourselves, more of them are going to come and say, they're listening, like I can be here now.
Yes, I love the way you're expressing that. Sometimes talk about it as going further and faring worse. And it's because we're creating more space through meditation, through being committed to presence, to allow the parts of us who have not yet been met with compassion in this life to come up to be healed. And there becomes kind of a patient, gentle, courageous, very wholesome understanding that this is the path. We say in Tibetan Vajrayana, obstacles do not block the path, obstacles are the path. And we talk a lot about discomfort, resiliency, recognizing the brilliance of the kind of discomfort of being with aspects of ourself and our human experience, again, that have not yet been healed, that we recognize now is the time. Now there's enough space for me to meet this with curiosity and care rather than judgment and freak out. Or personally, that this affirms that I'm a bad person, that this emotion is arising. Like, okay, this is here. And it's because we're developing enough trust in the heart, and I would say the shared heart, to recognize that we have room to hold all of it. And this goes back to darkness because it means we have room to hold a full spectrum of light and dark, that we can stop resisting and fearing like one half of our human experience.
There's also a sort of a way in which you approach this from the literal day and night darkness, the lights turned on and lights turned off darkness of our lives, and the ways in which at least those of us who have a certain amount of material privilege find ourselves surrounded by burning electrical lights and LEDs and passing car lights and ambient street lights and like that. We don't actually really, it sort of mirrors the way in which we might avoid our own inner anger or fear. We also try and light up the whole world so that there's no corner where you can't see everything. And that takes a toll in a way and also reinforces the message. I wonder if you could talk a bit more about the kind of systemic structural piece of this. And there are other systemic structural aspects as well, but maybe we'll start with that. Just literal, like, we leave the lights on a lot. It's a really bright, shiny, too bright world sometimes.
We leave the lights on a lot. I'm staying right now at a retreat center where it's such a privilege to have a mostly dark environment at night, or they've designed it with minimal lighting. Like, what's the minimal amount needed for safety on paths, but no more? And I just notice how my whole animal body relaxes and responds in this way. And also that the darkness invites more of an embodied, awake, sensory aliveness as I'm moving through the night. So what I talk about in the book is the overlighting of our planet alongside the overlighting of human consciousness. You know, I find it fascinating that if we look back into history, humanity spent most of our time here without electricity and without fire. Most of our time here experiencing the full spectrum of day and night. And a lot of incredibly rich experience emerged through cultures that spent time just gazing at the night sky, just being sky, embracing it. And so there's many ways I could talk about this, but one way I'll talk about it is alongside, I think, propensity towards egocentricity and anthropocentricity, which I both talk about in the book, is a leaning towards wake centricity, kind of an attachment to this, who we are in the domain of daylight, the rational mind, that which is familiar, that which we can see and understand cognitively, forgetting about a whole other aspect of our being, which is the dreamer, which is the unknown, which is the mystery, the realm of possibility. And we've created a really loud human-centered world, which these bright with most of the planet now overlit at night, 90% of the US and Europe, 60 something percent of the globe, which is significant, right?
Wow.
And so kind of this focus on, you know, for many people, it's like waking up and I turn on my device and I'm very aware of who I am in the human centered world, but maybe forgetting some of who we are in the larger sense and some of our capacities beyond what's required of us to survive the human designed world. What comes up for you when I speak of that?
Yeah, that statistic is pretty intense. 90% of Europe and US and 60% of the globe. Not surprising necessarily, but like, wow, it puts a fine point on it. You know, some of my most memorable experiences are, you know, these are experiences of intimacy, experiences of community, experiences of sort of joy and meaning and even almost like myth, like mythic, like they happen in the darker hours. You know, there's just something about the magic of nighttime that feels essential to the sort of mythic and poetic and kind of kinetic and intimate aspects of ourselves that, like, when the light's on and you're working and the computer screen, like, you have to like think and worry a lot more about how you look and how you present and how you fit in. But at night, there's some inhibitory sort of stuff is lifted. And, you know, just even the simple act on the solstice this past year on December 21st, I was like, I'm gonna make a fire out in the fire pit and just stare at it for 20 minutes. That's my commitment. And it was just best. My partner came out, the kids were asleep, and we just stared at the fire together for 20 minutes. Like, that was one of my best memories of the holiday season this year, was staring at the fire for 20 minutes, the darkness around us, unafraid of that, feeling the closeness of each other. And yeah, that's what comes up when you talk about that.
I love the words that you use to express that, and just that 20-minute memory. How simple, how distilled, how deep it was. And to consider that so much of what we've designed in the human-centered world is about bright lights, busyness, distraction, keeping busy, staying filled. Darkness is the domain of restoration, of non-emptying, which many people are afraid of and is the path to freedom. The domain of real restoration, the domain where we awaken the dreamer. It's so important, I think, for us on so many levels to remember to spend intentional time in the dark and time together in receptivity rather than doing an activity. It's so interesting that you shared that memory amidst the holidays, because the holidays are a real time of togetherness. But many people I talk to acknowledge my calendar's so full, it's all about doing, 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 and about time to just be together.
And there's almost a way in which, there's a big sadness in me this holiday, and the anger too, a lot in the holiday season. Sort of the Scrooge in me was like, look at what we do to each other. Look at what we make each other do for each other to sort of somehow like demonstrate. And it's like, God, all I want is to just have a beautiful meal and sit and laugh and let the kids play with each other, and that would literally be enough. And if something beautiful and mystical punctuates in that, even better. But it doesn't even have to be some grand, spiritual enlightenment. It just this to just slow down and say, what this is what matters is you and I breaking bread together and laughing together or crying together or sitting in silence together. That's was really I was really feeling the longing for that this holiday season more than ever.
I imagine there are so many listeners who can resonate with that. Just the deep natural desire for being together, and again, being in more of that non-doing space. Just this is enough. This is enough. And one of the ways in which I talk about darkness is that darkness is also a great teacher of and reminder of our relational intelligence and relational forms of knowing. Like, even in this conversation, there's a way in which we're hanging out in the dark together, because nothing here is scripted or controlled or has an agenda of where this conversation goes. We just showed up, never having met before, and are dropping into emergent, in the moment. As it unfolds, conversation, even that is touching the darkness, because we're dropping any familiar script or control. It's crave and need. It's what nourishes us. Times to just be in the dark, unfolding together. But instead, a lot of the existence people have is filled, scripted. And also, there's this illusion of control, people almost trying to get away from the unknown, even if it's what they crave. Does that make sense?
Makes me want to circle back another big, which you've touched on a bit. Maybe we can open it up some more.
Sure.
Is the sort of the dominant hierarchical sort of structure that rewards light and punishes dark or represses dark, and the ways that that shows up and how we treat people of different of lighter or darker skin colors of it shows up in the ways in which we prioritize certain emotions as allowable culturally and others as being seen as problematic. Like, yeah, you spend a fair bit of the book kind of looking at this hierarchical perception and also demonstrating how it shows up in our culture and our society in ways that are really harmful. I wonder if you could speak to that a bit more.
Sure, yeah. Originally this awareness came simply from paying attention to my own mind. Being a longtime meditator and then moving into being a Buddhist Dharma teacher, and just seeing these patterns amidst so many of us, and then looking at the systems that have passed down generation upon generation, this hierarchical perception lens, and that it's not, again, our original perception, that we have it in us to simply experience life as it is through what I call more of a willingness to see with the heart, but that there's this overlay in the human mind and the human ego, where again, we're constantly judging light versus dark, good versus bad, higher versus lower. And I'll name that in my own path, just seeing the harm that that caused internally, right? And then looking out in the world and just recognizing how much harm has been caused. I mean, we could have multiple conversations about this topic, how much harm has been caused. Oh my gosh. But through the racism that has ensued, the xenophobia, the judging of anyone who's quote unquote appears different and therefore gets othered, the judging of experiences that are outside the box. And there's a lot I could say about this. So I'm looking within to see what I want to focus on. But I will say, I talk about in the book, you know, going back throughout history, recognizing the first world religion that kind of perhaps brought in this consciousness of good versus bad, higher versus lower, Zoroastrianism, really, 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 really long time ago. And yet so many wisdom traditions and religions since then have carried that pulse. Does that make sense? And so today we hardly even recognize that it's perhaps not our original consciousness that it perhaps overlaps.
As I was reading this part of the book, and I'm appreciating you kind of gently saying like, hey, well, there might be some historical precedent here. There was a part of me going, and so maybe we can like, maybe this will be a good source of some friction or debate or exploration, but there was a part of me that was going like, hell yes, this is this power over structure, which says, you know, you can kind of pick the context. I, the king, have the divine access to the God, or I, the priest, or I, the wealthiest, or whatever the sort of this kind of individualistic I, someone at the top of the pyramid. Like, that's so clear to me that that dominator hierarchy has produced all, as you've just said, all this pain. And there's another voice to me going, but there are people who are more skilled at something, or there are ways in which it's really helpful for a group to have a person or a group of people who provide orienting function. Or so another part of me resisted completely eradicating hierarchical perception, but rather wondering if there is some nuance to it, or some ways in which we've twisted it to, it's been twisted towards someone's gain. I'm curious to hear how you work with that question or that inquiry.
Here's one really perhaps simple way you can frame it is this. I mean, we could look simply to the world of nature, the animal kingdom. We could say, look, the lion has so much more prowess and power and strength, right, than the mouse. Yes, that's obviously true. And yet, does the lion have more intrinsic value than the mouse? Those are two very different questions. Can you see what I'm pointing to?
Yeah, nice. Yeah. And when we're even seeing it, that just to pick up and play with that, that's really helpful. Like, if we extinguished mice from the planet, that would take an uncountable toll on the whole ecosystem. And if we extinguished lions from the planet, that would take, like, the system works because you have mice and lions and everything in between, right?
And then it brings into question the whole humans have made up, though we assert it as truth, the whole food chain anyway. And you're talking about systems. And as we study systems more and more, we become aware that perhaps microbes, the teeniest, tiniest beings in existence, are actually most in control of everything.
Yes, and when we try and like sanitize them away, we're making ourselves sicker and perhaps creating all of these follow-on effects that we can anticipate with our autoimmune disorders and our, and yeah, like there's anytime we try and scrub some problem out, like, right, to bring the sanitizing light completely in and quote unquote disinfect the problem, we just produce all these other problems.
We produce all these other problems. And there's a section in the book where I talk about sort of the what it means to really embrace our earth bodies and our earth bodies as domains of that we're sharing our bodies with so many forms of life and kind of erasing or inviting people to erase the notion of the light body trying to get to this ultimately pure, spiritually pure, physically pure. There's many ways we could frame it, but holding this ideal, which takes
Yeah,
us.
purity is almost like actually shorthand for a kind of violence, isn't it? Was,
You
yeah.
got it. It's fascinating. Just going back to what we were talking about for a moment. I do a lot of work helping people to, in leadership positions, in communities, embrace relational mindfulness, relational intelligence, and really shift from a kind of tendency towards power over to power with, shared power, really investigating what do we mean by shared power. And when we go from the connections we just made from the domain of nature, let's say, to just recognizing how often human-built structures now are based in hierarchies that really don't serve. There's a way that we can create systems, communities, organizations where we're recognizing that authentic power is shared power. Authentic power is the power of our having a strong weave in the fabric of human relationship, recognizing the intrinsic value of the whole rather than the higher lower models. This is basic stuff, but it's stuff that a lot of communities and a lot of organizations and a lot of leaders need help with because there's been so much conditioning from capitalism, from patriarchy, from colonialism, from everything that we've experienced up till now. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm in touch with I'm really appreciating the distinction between power over versus power with, and I'm in touch with this, I'm reminded of something I've thought before and learned from other people before. This one of the most powerful ways to have power over is to obviously fear and force are sources of power over, but there's also sort of, for lack of a better word in this moment, like seduction, to sort of say, hey, I'm the one with the most power, but if you do X, Y, and Z, you'll be close to my power. If you're loyal to this being my ascendance, my strength, my dominance, my accumulation of wealth, you'll get some of that. And for that to work, there's some other people who can't get any of it. So in a way, that sort of power with a power over model perpetuates because someone, it just has this seductive element. Someone who's really keen on acquiring power realizes that they can seduce other people with that power if they kind of dangle enough fruit for them to take a bite of.
Absolutely. And it becomes a very it's an area we have a lot of work to do in as human beings, obviously. And it's an area that becomes really interesting in terms of the spread of consciousness, in terms of spiritual teachings and spiritual teachers. I have witnessed equally incredible models of power with of teachers and leaders who are willing to show up with some of the qualities that I consider inducive to power with, and that means vulnerability. I talk about it as showing up naked. I teach and lead from my whole self. I don't have some kind of leader persona or some kind of false confidence I'm trying to put out or wanting to be a projection screen. I show up as I am and show up naked. Vulnerability and reciprocity and being part of as what I'm modeling, not being the teacher bestowing the wisdom. And equal to that, I've seen so many models of people in powerful positions, leaders and teachers, really abusing power in ways subtle and not so subtle, somehow pointing back to what you were just speaking of, creating frames where it's, I've got the gold, and if you do what I say, or if you sign this invisible contract, maybe you could get some of it too. Yeah.
What's your sense at this moment in our journey? You know, there's a part of me right now that like wishes I could somehow travel back in time to the early dawn of civilization and kind of the population growth of that time and the accumulation of material goods and all of the things that sort of, like there was a point in human history where if someone was too acquisitive and wanted too much power in a group of people, there was no hiding. There was no like state edifice to, it was just like, hey, you're part of our group, stop it. And if you don't stop it, like we're gonna shame you or exile you, or in some cases even, you know, kill you, which like, I, you know, a part of me, like the civilized part of me is like, ooh, but you know, we just took care of that stuff as a group of people, as groups of people, right when they were happening. And now we're at a place where someone can accrue massive amounts of institutional power over strangers that they'll never meet in their life. And it's really like, it's a real big risk to trust someone, a political leader, a corporate leader. I shouldn't even use the word leader because that implies like some kind of like activity, like just a authority, an authority figure. It's really just, it's just so risky and fraught now, and it seems kind of inescapable. A part of me wishes I could go back and change it, but we can't. We're here now. What's your sense of how we walk in a world where there are that kind of power centers, and what it is for us to stand in the face of that and to cultivate power with when there are so many institutions of power over all around us?
Thank you. That's such a big question. There's a couple different things I want to talk to you about in response. And the first is just there are some helpful guidelines for how to exist in a world of so many power dynamics, where that is part of our life every day. There's no getting away from that. But can we show up to existing power dynamics as centered and present within our own spiritual sovereignty as we can? Can we show up owning our projections onto anyone of power, really owning and investigating those projections so we're clear who that person is and what we're actually projecting, and then look at how we're showing up? Are we giving away our power unnecessarily? Is that assumed that it's written into the contract? Are we practicing transparency, truth-telling, speaking up, which often people are not because of power dynamics in institutions? Oh, I can't speak up. I shouldn't speak up. I live and exist in a community of where we're practicing transparency in really courageous ways. And I see the impact all the time of what happens when people bring that transparency, which is speaking our in the moment truth from the heart to corporations where they work or lead, to really complex communities, to conflicts where we're navigating racial complexity, and to all kinds of domains where transparency is needed as the medicine to kind of break up existing or old cobwebby power dynamics. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And then there's a lot, you know, I mean, your question was big, but we're navigating so much that is simply offensive and hard to witness today regarding power, insane amounts of power and money in the hands of a few. So there's an important piece of work, I believe, for people to do actually around grief. When we don't metabolize our collective grief, and often the grief is there, it's harder to feel, it's more uncomfortable to feel than the anger, the outrage, the finger pointing, the reactivity, the paralysis. So sometimes people stay there on the levels. But if we're willing to sink down more fully and be with and metabolize our grief about what's happened, our grief about where we've come, then we access an even more potent capacity to respond skillfully, and I'll use the word powerfully. Does that make sense?
Thank you for sharing that. I was appreciating your insights about vulnerability and transparency, and was caught kind of pleasantly by surprise when you went to grief. Maybe we could just be with that a little bit more fully. Like I'm noticing right now, yeah, it is really fucking sad. It's really sad how much loss and pain there is in the world, how many people are dying, how many children are dying, not just because of active conflicts right now, but like pick a year in the past 2 centuries, and you can the statistics around infant mortality, and just it's just awful. So sad. And there's a part of me that's like, I can't even look at that, because then if I look at it, it's gonna break me. And you're saying, you might actually need to look at that, Andy. You might actually need to feel that if you're gonna contribute to this moment. Is that right? And like, say more about.
100%, and that the tendency and what's more popular is I want to transcend these difficult feelings, get away from them, avoid them. And so let's go into mentalism or heady debates on Facebook about our anger about these things or finger pointing. It all happens. I'm pointing up to my head in a domain that's easier and oddly more comfortable to be with, but does not let us metabolize our grief and our ancestral pain. Metabolization is what I'd like to see in our time. It's what I see transforms communities and individuals to being able to show up in an even more wholehearted response. It's about a sacred sobering of taking in through our feeling bodies, not through heady debate what's happening today and where that lands us.
Lovely. In that spirit, my son is at the door asking for a little hug, so I'm going to pause and give him a hug, and then we'll come back, and I think we're coming towards the close of our time together. But thank you for that. And I sense like a bit of a challenge in that invite of like, yeah, I don't know if I've really fully grieved how sad it is where we're at. I'm gonna give this little guy, in that spirit, I'm gonna give this guy a little hug. Okay, hugs have been given. The little guy's off to whatever he's up to next. And yeah, I'd love to hear anything else that you want to add about this piece.
Hugs have been given and received, the most
Okay.
important aspect.
Yes.
I simply want to, remind us all that one of the perhaps greatest fractures happened in human consciousness and got us to where we are today, simply in the time period where we made the move from being more land-based and more living from a consciousness embedded in the natural world to the agrarian revolution and the agricultural revolution, acknowledging how much changed in that time in how humans related to land, to the earth. That seeded so much of the changes that happened since. And part of what we're navigating today is still the leftovers, the remnants of so many people living in disconnection from their earth bodies, disconnection from the earth that makes navigating everything we're navigating today far more challenging and confusing. Even the piece we were just talking about metabolizing our grief, we can do that when we are resting in our earth connection, feeling ourselves not as separate, but as part of something much larger. This is perhaps the most important teaching of Endarkenment. It offers a lot of encouragements for how to get back into our earth bodies and a perception lens that understands that we are not separate, that understands, in the phrase Thich Nhat Hanh speaks, the late Thich Nhat Hanh, interbeing.
Mm-hmm.
And that heals so much. So much. And so again, the world of bright lights in many ways takes us further into a sense of separation, individual isolation, me consciousness, me part of the rat race, all encouragement to find ways to pause that, to disrupt that, to, as you described earlier, claim your 20 minutes of intimacy under the night sky, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty simple.
Gosh. Yeah. There is there's something moving in me right now. Just give me a minute to
take your time.
Yeah, there is a sense of like I'm hearing in what you've just described, both like the deep tragedy and but also the potential simplicity of return. Like the deep tragedy is that it only took a generation or two or three to be born into a world where everyone around you says, this is reality. And you,
yes.
And you just, you know, this little 3-year-old who just gave me a hug. It's like just trying to figure out reality and okay, got it. It's got lights and walls. And, you know, at the time you were talking about the Agrarian Revolution, say, like, okay, got it. Like, we live in these huts and we work this land and there's someone who has weapons and soldiers over in that building that we have to kind of pay respect to. Got it. This is reality. And how quickly in a few generations we were able to sort of forget through that, like we're just born not as a blank slate, but we're born with so much absence of knowledge about reality. So that's really just the tragedy of that. But then also your invitation towards it's just if we gave ourselves permission to turn off the lights, to be with the night, to be with our bodies, it's all still right there. Culturally, we may have forgotten, but biologically, genetically, evolutionary, we're talking millions and millions of years. It's all right there in us. And that's hopeful to me right now.
Yeah.
In this moment.
Thank you. Yes. And that part of the symbolism of the night and of darkness is the domain of the dreamer, of possibility, remembering that we are living in an emergent mystery all the time, beyond the illusion of control, beyond the illusion of this is the paradigm I was born into, so it's clearly set in stone. Not true. Paradigms have changed throughout history.
Yeah.
So really encouraging people to pause often enough, to spend enough time in the dark, physically and metaphorically, in the mind of not knowing, rather than knowing,
mm-hmm.
let some of those connections be made again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's, it makes me think of sort of the myth of the Tuatha De Danann, who are supposedly an indigenous mystical people who predated sort of the Celtic Irish people of Ireland and Scotland, and as the Tuatha De Danann and you know the Celts sort of met, there were of course unions and love and romance, you know, in this mythic telling, but also war and violence and loss. And at some point the Tuatha De Danann said, it's time for us to go. And the story goes that they just kind of turned and stepped and disappeared. And what I'm in touch with in that kind of poetic myth is this idea that actually that was just us. We could just turn and step and face and go, oh, there's this here. There's this night. There's this mystery. There's this unknown that's just a step away from us. And it feels like a whole other species, a whole other creature, but no, that's just us. We could just turn and step and bring that back. It's just right over there.
Yes.
Even though it feels like it's gone from the world.
Beautiful. I love the way you're framing that. Yes. And that it's really an imperative of our times that we remember this, that we spend more time remembering and questioning. And I just want to share earlier, we were talking about dynamics around power and authority, and simply having a committed practice of resting in meditation, resting in the darkness and not knowing, resting in receptivity, and remembering the wisdom of our earth bodies, I'm going to use that phrase again, helps us to know in an unwavering way, in an unquestioning way, in a direct experience of, oh my gosh, who and what I am is an expression of the natural intelligence of this larger system, and this natural intelligence that is so brilliant. If I can lean into that more and trust the internal authority of the heart, which I speak of as the shared heart, not just me and my ego, then I can show up to be of service and to respond in a really different way, a much more creative, skillful, in the moment, consciously responding way to the challenges we're facing. Yeah.
Thank you, Eden. I really appreciate the invitation you're offering in this conversation and your book and your work. This has been a meaningful one for me at this moment in my journey. So thank you.
I really appreciated our conversation and all that you brought to it. And thank you for being willing to connect so soon after navigating flu.
I know. Well, you know, it's we've been trying to get this one on the books for a while, and life, as one of my mentors says, is lifey. Things happen. We get sick. Someone else we love gets sick, you know, all this stuff. And I've just so appreciated that we've stayed committed to making this conversation happen. And it feels now at this moment, perfectly timed for me. So, you know, I sort of take that as a gift.
I'm with you.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. We'll include all the details in the show notes, but if people want to find the book as they're just listening in this moment, what's the best place for them to go learn more about the book and your work?
They can visit my website, DeborahEdenToll.com, and there's also information about all three of my books on Amazon. And, you know, I'd like to encourage that if people love it, if the book moves you and changes something in you, it's always generous to a writer to offer a review, an expression of appreciation. Before I started writing, I rarely took the time to write reviews. And once I was like, oh my gosh, it takes so much to put a book out in the world. I'm going to start giving reviews for all the books that move me.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, it's such a, you know, any book is a labor of love. And, you know, we could debate about which books are quote unquote good books and all, there's the hierarchical thing again. But there's no doubt that someone has had to sit and think and feel deeply for an extended period of time to produce a volume of paper with ink printed on it that you might hold in your hand, or, yeah. You know, so that's really, yeah. It is a special kind of act, and to celebrate that. Yeah. Thank you, Eden. Okay. Thanks everyone for listening in.
Thanks for tuning into the Wonder Dome. This podcast was produced by me, Andy Cahill, with support from Kaylee Serqua, and post-production by Jim Serqua of Sump Pump Studios. The Wonder Dome is recorded and produced primarily on unceded Nipmuc territory. I honor their ongoing leadership and stewardship of the land. I trace my own ancestral roots to Celtic peoples from Ireland and Scotland, and to Anglo and Germanic tribes across northwestern Europe. We all come from somewhere, we're all going somewhere. May the wisdom of our ancestors guide us, and may we find our own wisdom along the way. The theme song was written and performed by Todd Marston. You can find the Wonder Dome wherever pods are casted. If you dig what we're doing here, please share widely, subscribe, and give us some love on the review boards. If you feel called to support this humble offering while making an even greater impact in the lives of others, consider becoming a monthly supporter. You can find out more at my website, thewonderdomepodcast.com. Until then, I'm wishing you a life of purpose, power, and presence. We need you now, more than ever.